Hi there, it's Andrew Doyle here. Before we get into this week's show, I just wanted to let you know about the new daily newsletter from Spiked, which is called Today on Spiked, does what it says on the tin. And with that, you'll get a roundup of all Spiked's content each day, plus you'll get exclusive commentary from the Spiked team. So make sure that you never miss an article. Go to spiked-online.com/newsletters to sign up. Thanks very much. Hello and welcome to Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle. Today I am thrilled to welcome Christopher Rufo. Christopher is a filmmaker, an investigative journalist. He's probably best known for uncovering the widespread use of critical race theory in the American federal government and in the educational system. And his reporting actually led the Trump administration to issue their executive order banning race and sex stereotyping. Christopher is also a contributing editor to City Journal, and he's the director of the Discovery Institute's Center on Wealth and Poverty. As you will know, the UK has always poached aspects of American culture. We've taken their movies, their slang, their childhood obesity, just everything, basically. So we're always a few years behind. And I think if you want to see where the culture wars are heading, or where they might be heading if we don't take a stand, you really want to look across the Atlantic. So I think that Christopher's work really shows that that is somewhere we do not want to be. So take this episode as a warning and hope you enjoy it. So Chris, what is your background exactly? I think a lot of the people listening to this will be interested to know how you got involved in critical race theory specifically, because you used to write a lot about other issues, didn't you? Homelessness, drug addiction, that kind of thing. So how did you make this transition?
Yeah, I actually, you know, I spent the first 10 plus years of my career as a documentary film director, and I directed films for our public television here, PBS, for Netflix and other international TV stations. So I kind of learned the basics of reporting as a film producer, film director. Then I started covering in a film for public television issues of American poverty. Then spent a number of years covering homelessness and addiction, primarily in America's West Coast cities. And then made this transition to covering critical race theory, which was, you know, in some ways different, but in some ways derived from the same progressive ideologies that I had been covering in cities like Seattle and San Francisco and Los Angeles. And then the last 6 months or so, that's been a big focus of mine.
Well, it feels like it's overtaken your life a little bit. I mean, I often look at your very impressive Twitter threads. It's almost like you've become the kind of go-to person for anyone who's in an institution who needs to leak some of this information about what exactly is going on. It seems like you're the person they go to. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, that you're exactly right. And it happened, you know, at first by accident. I'd reported on one story, and then I started getting a flood of leaks and whistleblowers. I now have a database of more than 1,000 different leaks and whistleblowers from American institutions. Everything from small, you know, local elementary schools all the way up to the most kind of powerful departments in the United States federal government. And it's been kind of strange. It's something I didn't plan. It's something that happened in a way by accident, but I've taken on the role as a kind of go-to source looking at the role of race theory in the institutions.
I think that's really important, because I think I get this a lot. People talk to me when I write about critical race theory and this kind of thing. What I get is people saying to me, but really, how prevalent is this? Well, firstly, they don't quite understand what it is. So maybe we should clarify that. Could you give us, I mean, this is a big question and there's obviously lots of literature on this, but if you were to explain to someone who had no idea what critical race theory is, could you summarize it in a few sentences? Is that even possible?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, you can't capture all the nuances. But, you know, basically, in the American context, critical race theory is the idea that the United States is a fundamentally racist country, and that all American institutions, social institutions, the law, the Constitution, individual rights, culture, are all kind of promising a kind of liberal democratic vision, but in reality are masking or camouflaging racist oppression and domination. And the race theorists basically say racism is a kind of foundational state of being, and we are attempting to excavate it and expose the kind of corrupt and white supremacist nature of American society.
And I always advise people, if they want to get a sort of firm grip on this stuff, is just to read Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, because I think she, of all those who have this fealty to critical race theory, she's the one who sort of, I suppose, says the quiet parts out loud. She makes it very, very explicit where she's coming from.
Yeah. And it's also a book that is, you know, easy to read. It's not a kind of Harvard Law Review article. It's something easy to read. And
yes,
I think, you know, it really isn't complicated. That's the thing. And I guess, in a sense, the original insight of critical race theory in the 1990s wasn't necessarily bad. It was basically saying a lot of the scholarship and a lot of the institutional work had neglected the role of race. We should take a closer look. And mm-hmm. I personally agree with that. I think that's a good premise. The problem is that from that premise, they went to the conclusion that is really kind of rehashed 1960s radical rhetoric from the Black Power movement, from, you know, the United States kind of communist activists in the 1960s, Angela Davis, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That, to me, it's the ideology that failed in the 1960s and now has kind of revived itself in the 2020s, which I think is quite astonishing.
And I think one of the problems relating to that is the way in which critical race theorists effectively suggest or repudiate the idea that there has been any progress since the civil rights movements of the 1960s, and the way in which so much of it appears to be taken on faith. The idea that if there are unequal outcomes, that is taken of evidence of systemic or structural racism. And you know, in White Fragility, you know, Robin DiAngelo is quite clear that she thinks that every human interaction contains evidence of systemic and structural racism. And obviously, what you say is right, that there is some utility to that at some point, because there can be such a thing as an institution that is racist. That is possible. But I suppose one of my concern is that is taken on faith, irrespective of whatever evidence is produced. That's a real problem, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that it's really a kind of a conviction that can't be debated. And what they've done that I think works well, and the reason why it's been able to spread through institutions so rapidly and so effectively, is that they basically make this kind of mousetrap argument where they make these outrageous broad claims. The racism is everywhere. There's been no racial progress in American history. And, you know, all of our institutions are white supremacist in nature. I mean, the evidence of that is really very thin. But if you disagree, if you say no, if you debate, that's evidence of your white fragility, evidence of your internalized white supremacy, evidence of your internalized racism. And therefore, most people just don't speak up and they let these programs happen. They accept the ideology, not because they believe the truth in it, but because they've been intimidated by the practice and the kind of pragmatic politics within the institution.
Absolutely. There's a morning TV show in the UK, and there's a presenter called Philip Schofield. You won't know him, but he asked the question of an activist. He was asking about Meghan Markle, and she was making the case that the poor treatment of Meghan Markle by the press was definitely down to racism. And he asked for evidence of this. And she said, "The fact that you were asking me for evidence is evidence that we live in a systemically racist country." And that's sort of what you're describing, isn't it? To even question the premise is taken as further substantiation for what could, after all, be a false premise to begin with. How do you counter that?
I think it just takes courage. It's not really an intellectual problem, right? I think the intellectual argument against it is actually pretty easy. You demand evidence, you provide evidence to the contrary. You use your common sense that I think is probably consonant with most people's view of these issues. But the thing that is not lacking is good argument. The thing that is lacking is courage. And I think people are too scared to wade into these issues, too scared to go up against people who are certainly going to call you a racist or a bigot or white supremacist. And people, you know, are scared for their jobs. They're scared for their livelihood. They're scared for their reputations. And they make the calculation that it's easier just to be silent. And that, to me, is really the kind of key area, is actually having people armed with not only the kind of evidence and argument, but also the kind of moral virtue of courage in order to stand up and fight it.
So how does that make you feel? I mean, you must be constantly on the receiving end of people claiming you're a racist, white supremacist, because you're such a visible figure who is challenging this stuff. I mean, how do you cope with that?
You know, it's actually weird. I was working on issues of homelessness and kind of local politics in Seattle, Washington, a very progressive West Coast city. And I was, you know, writing kind of research papers and articles on homelessness and, you know, was on the receiving end of all of those horrible epithets, which is strange because it's not really a racial issue at all. The large majority of homeless people in Seattle are white. And then I shifted to critical race theory. And as you suggest, I said, oof, I better get ready to be called all sorts of bad names.
Yeah.
It actually hasn't happened.
Really?
I'm not sure why. I don't want to jinx it. I don't want to give anyone ideas, but it really hasn't happened. And I think I know why.
Go on.
Because I'm not arguing in the abstract. I'm not saying, X, Y, and Z about racism and kind of general or abstract terms, which will open you up to a lot of those attacks. And you know, it's easier to debate, right? Things are easier to debate as general ideas.
Yeah.
I'm really focused on investigative reporting and showing the facts. So I'm saying, here's a school in Cupertino, California that was forcing third grade public school students to deconstruct their racial and sexual identities and then rank themselves according to their power and privilege. I report those facts. It's so outrageous. It's almost undebatable that this is wrong.
Yeah.
And then it really forces people that are in the kind of critical race theory camp on the defensive rather than attacking me because I'm just reporting verifiable facts.
Yeah. Well, I'm jealous because I get it a lot. And I think because I satirize the woke movement because I mock them. And so people interpret that, or rather misinterpret that, as punching down at minority groups. So it winds me up because, as you say, the promiscuous use of that phrase, racist, white supremacist, that, you know, the ease with which people are willing to smear people in this way with no evidence whatsoever. I mean, it is really disgraceful, to be honest.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, the punching down point is really interesting because you're absolutely not punching down, you're punching up. I mean, yeah. The people who are perpetuating and developing critical race theory in the institutions are at the highest levels of government, of corporations, of technology, of media, of academia. I mean, the folks who are perpetuating in the name of the kind of dispossessed are really just using this to bolster their own social status, right? Someone right. like Robin DiAngelo, you know, she is using this ideology to kind of sell books and sell herself and you know, make herself feel kind of valuable as an activist. But really the question is, does any of this actually improve conditions for the poor and marginalized, you know, Black Americans in cities like Memphis or Detroit or Newark? Mm-hmm. I don't think it does. I actually am, you know, writing a paper for the Heritage Foundation arguing that actually the kind of intellectual argument behind critical race theory actually serves to undermine the well-being of the most marginalized.
Yes, that's my instinct too. I'd be very interested to read what you come up with there. I mean, you mentioned how powerful these people are, which I think is absolutely right. They're all, as you say, in the top levels of government and academia and so forth, but also cultural institutions and the arts and the media and even Hollywood, of course, very much the establishment. So when people say to me, oh, this sort of stuff, it's not very prevalent, we don't need to worry about it going into schools, it might be the odd school here and there where they've got an overzealous teacher who thinks they're a rebel or an activist, but really it's not that big a deal. Can you give us a sense of how prevalent this is?
Yeah, I mean, in schools, it's absolutely kind of widespread. It's ubiquitous. And there are now three states, California, Oregon, Illinois, and Washington is coming. Four huge American states with probably the population of Great Britain that have institutionalized critical race theory and kind of Marxist pedagogy of the oppressed into the official state curriculum and academic standards. So they're right. teaching kindergartners how to deconstruct your racial identity. They're teaching first graders how to think about kind of liberation and protest. These are not kind of isolated incidents. These are actually becoming the kind of state mandated dogma that is teaching millions of students in the United States. And if it hasn't already happened in the UK, I imagine it's on its way.
I think we're a few years behind, but we're definitely getting there. I've got some teacher friends. I mean, I had a teacher friend texted me today actually saying, just to let you know, I'm in the middle of an unconscious bias training session. And I texted back saying, I think you should tell them right now, it's been debunked. It has no effect. You know, and that I think goes back to what you're saying about bravery. But actually, I really feel for the teacher. I used to be a teacher, you see, and a lot of the teachers I know, they're getting documents through, such as reading lists, which feature Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi and people like that. And there are a number of things to consider there. Firstly, I don't see the relevance of critical race theory in the UK, because I think critical race theory specifically came out of America's very specific history with slavery and race relations. And to just simply map that into a UK context, I don't think works. That's the first thing. But more and more, I've been contacted by lots of teachers here who are saying they're being told similar things. Lots of schools are making statements about how they're going to decolonize the curricula. And my general impression is that a lot of the people doing this here, at least, are well-intentioned and think that all they're doing is taking a stand against racism, that they don't really understand what they're doing. That's the impression I get. Do you think that's similar in the US, or do you think it's a specifically UK thing?
Yeah, no, I think it is similar, and I think it's very attractive, right? It's very seductive, and I think especially in the educational setting, the issue is that education is hard. Mm. Teaching students, especially in, you know, poor communities or urban school districts, is not easy. The public education system in the United States, especially for those poor students, is a total disaster. And trying to get your school district, right? I'm just putting out a new story in the next couple of days in Philadelphia, where only 5 to 10% of public school students in this school are reading and doing math at grade level. So 95% right. of them are barely literate, even by fifth and sixth grade. You know, it's an actually difficult challenge to get their academic performance up, but it's actually very easy to hold a mock protest or to protest systemic racism or to blame white supremacy or to, you know, implement anti-racist trainings. These are easy things to do that feel good, that seem correct, that are used in many cases to divert attention from the just enormous failure of public education.
And at what point will people react against this? You say that some of the threads and the leaked information that you put out there, and I've seen a lot of it, a lot of the documents you put out there, it's so egregious and so outrageous and so obviously a kind of new racism. I know Peter Boghossian has been calling it neo-racism, and I think this is right. The thing that springs most obviously to mind is Brentwood School in California, that story from last week where they'd set up these dialogue sessions and they'd divided parents and teachers according to the color of their skin. How can anyone look at that and think this is not massively regressive? The logical endpoint of this is segregation, isn't it?
No, yeah, it's not even the logical endpoint. It's the logical point that we already are in. I've reported on, you know, more than a dozen institutions in the United States that have implemented racial segregation for diversity training, for parent groups, for student groups. What they're calling them affinity groups.
But right.
They're racial affinity groups where they're dividing people. I even posted pictures from the King County, Washington Public Library, where they were conducting training sessions and they had put papers on two different doors, session for white people, session for people of color. I mean, it was reminiscent of the old water fountain photos that you would see from the segregation era in the United States. And I reported it. They got some backlash, but they basically said, we don't have to do anything. This is our institutional policy. If you oppose affinity groups, you oppose anti-racism. And nothing happened.
I suppose that was my point, is what do they do with the backlash? Because your work must generate backlash. So surely some people must be reconsidering their stance, are they? Or are you not getting that impression?
It depends on the kind of institutional politics and political culture of the specific area. But
yeah,
in these very progressive cities, there's really no political will to stop this. And I'll report on it. It'll go out there. It'll hit, you know, sometimes 10 or 20 million media impressions across different platforms. They'll have a national spotlight focused on their policies and they literally refuse. And I think this is really evidence of the kind of power dynamics of the double standard, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, any other form of racial segregation would be protested. The Department of Justice would investigate. It would be a huge national scandal. But progressive kind of political powers allied with kind of progressive media institutions can operate these programs with impunity because, frankly, the opposition lacks the practical political power to stop them.
I think this is what frustrates me most of all, is that I've always said that those behind what we might call the woke ideology, or what has become known as certainly the intersectional way of thinking, they're always the minority. You know, there's not that many of them. You don't meet people with these views day to day. You see them on Twitter because they have an overwhelming representation on Twitter, and they're quite aggressive on Twitter and vicious. But in real life, you don't really cut. And that's what I'm constantly faced. People often say to me, you know, well, these people you squabble with on Twitter, they're not in the real world. They're not out and about. But they do seem to have a lot of clout. They seem to have an awful lot of power. So it's almost as though, even if the majority says, this is wrong, we don't want our children segregated in this way, it doesn't matter because the ones with the power are sort of determining policy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you may have the majority, even a strong majority of public opinion, but public opinion is not the same thing as political power. You have to have control of institutions. You have to have mechanisms to use leverage against your opponents. And frankly, the majority doesn't have that, isn't organized. And, you know, I'm curious. I may actually disagree with you slightly, because if you look at the case of Ibram Kendi, Ibram Kendi is on every single reading list from every institution that I've reported on. Every single one. And you even mentioned it. It's for teachers in the UK. Reading Ibram Kendi is required reading. But if you notice his Twitter feed, it's quite interesting. He has very little organic support on Twitter, for example.
Right.
He's constantly getting ratioed. He's constantly getting, you know, pushed back against. It seems like he has very kind of few active followers. It makes me think that the power that someone like Ibram Kendi has is not actually organic or reaching a large public. It's institutional. His book is a bestseller, not because people are flocking to read it, but because the institutions are buying bulk copies. They're sending it to schools. They're putting it on lists. They're putting it in front of kind of shelves from the kind of PR side. And it's really a kind of artificial and orchestrated and frankly fake movement. A minority is using the power of the institutions to foist this upon the public with the perception of popular support that, in my view, maybe doesn't exist.
I think that's really reassuring. I think it's really great that Kendi's getting ratioed for some of the awful things he says. Although I do notice that people gave him a bit of a free pass when he talked about how horrified he would be if he had a trans child. I think if that was coming from anyone else, he might have even been kicked off Twitter for that.
That's probably right. And again, it's the double standard. And I think my ideas on the so-called cancel culture are kind of evolving and changing. But, the problem with the kind of principled, classical liberal, center-left, or even center-right position, which is I oppose cancel culture in all of its manifestations. I won't call for anyone to be canceled. I'll actually call even my opponents to not be canceled. You know, that's kind of has some moral integrity. It's consistent, but it ignores this massive power differential where, Ibram Kendi could cancel you, but you can't cancel Ibram Kendi. Is that kind of principled position actually prudent given the actual huge disparity of power within the institutions? I'm not sure. I'm still kind of sorting through it. I'd be curious to hear what you think.
You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show. I saw Dave Rubin doing a thread about this, and he's basically saying, you know, liberalism is ill-equipped to deal with this problem. But I think one of the problems you're going to face is that most people don't accept the power differential. But, for a start, the entire woke movement and critical race theorists generally have done a very successful job of promoting the idea that they are the underdogs, that they don't have the power at all. And therefore, the first step you would have to do is to convince people that they are, in fact, in charge. And that I still haven't found a way to successfully do that. But I think the other problem that you face is, as you say, as you've just said there, it's like there's a battle going on and one side is prepared to use guerrilla tactics and underhand tactics and the other side is not. It's going to go by gentlemanly conduct in war or the Geneva Convention or whatever. And of course, that's not going to work out, is it? However, I still stick to this idea that I think liberalism is the only way, isn't it? Because what would the alternative be to start playing their tactics? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I'm not suggesting that in those terms. I think you're right. The kind of liberal democratic tradition and structures and constitution are the only way. But I think you don't have to abandon those to actually fight a bit more intelligently, a bit more strategically, with a bit more tactical sophistication. And I think that you can hold those principles together while actually trying to use new tactics to fight. And I think one example, I have a lot of friends that signed the Harper's letter. You might have heard of it. Harper's is an old kind of classic American magazine. They signed this letter basically saying, we oppose cancel culture. We oppose the kind of authoritarian nature of some of the left. And what did it achieve? It kind of ran a news cycle, but after it, some of the signers of the Harper's letter ended up dropping out and denouncing it because they were getting canceled. And it exposed, I think, the good intentions of the kind of classical liberals, but also the kind of blindness to the dynamics of power. And I think conservatives and classical liberals and center-left people on the kind of dissident left need to actually say, how can we, I think, reach kind of weapons grade parity, so that we have the same level of kind of firepower as the kind of woke adversary. And then we can argue about kind of a truce or ending cancel culture or kind of having the gentlemanly warfare that you talk about. But from a position of overwhelming institutional weakness, you're going to be victim of the strong do what they can and the weak do what they must. And that's not a strong position to work from and to try to achieve outcomes from.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I read what Dave Rubin wrote. He was making very interesting, compelling points, you know, but I suppose I still have this faith that because the majority of people are instinctively about fair play, you know, I think that, and because the majority of people do oppose this stuff, I don't think it's about abandoning liberalism. I think what it is about is encouraging more people to take a stand, as in everyone, as in if you're in a workplace and you're told to have this training that teaches you that if you are white, you have this whiteness, you have this original sin, this kind of, you are complicit in white supremacy on the basis of your race, that you stand up and say, this is not true. And I'm not going to stand for this. And at the risk of being fired, but because there's the numbers behind it, if we can encourage people to just be a bit braver and to take that stand, then the liberal system will win out. Is that just really naive of me? It could be.
I don't think so. I am also optimistic for a number of reasons. One is that this all happened with extraordinary speed. I mean, the kind of perpetuation of this ideology through the institutions happened invisibly for many years, and then it's kind of just exploded in the last few years. So I think that as more people catch up with this, and I know conservative institutions are starting to finally catch up with this, there will be a more organized kind of resistance or organized opposition. And then I think, too, you're absolutely right. Most people want a good kind of job, a good source of employment, a stable family, a good education for their kids. They want those kind of basic building blocks of life. And I think the liberal democratic system has enabled those things to be reality for more people around the world than any other system in the history of humanity. And I think that we have, in some sense, taken for granted the benefits of our liberal government structure and culture. And we've, in a strange way, forgotten what they mean, forgotten what they provide, forgotten what they signify. And I think it will take not only a kind of fight against wokeness, but it'll kind of take another kind of reimagining and bringing back into the present that good legacy of liberalism. It's not all, you know, racism and white supremacy and slavery and segregation. Those are all historical truths that we should grapple with in a serious way, but we shouldn't let them obscure the really, I'm going to say it, glorious history of our institutions and this kind of steady progress that we've made over the last millennium.
Yeah, of course, people would say that by even suggesting there's anything positive about American history, you're complicit in white supremacy, or that you're pushing a white supremacist narrative, and that you better read the 1619 Project.
You know. But it's like, I don't know, that some of the greatest accomplishments in American history have been made by people of all different backgrounds.
Yeah.
I mean, look at like jazz as an art form is a kind of world historical treasure. You look at all the things that we've done as a country and involving people from all backgrounds, even people who at the time were oppressed, were able to contribute to this system. And I think that you have to be realistic. You can't be kind of jingoistic and say the United States has been perfect forever. It's the greatest thing to ever happen. There's nothing wrong. That's not true, but the other side isn't true either. I mean, it takes a kind of serious grappling with history to understand that in this complex battle between good and evil within the country, we've always eventually moved towards the greater good.
And do you get a sense of how people in minority communities are feeling about all this? I was listening to Helen Pluckrose talking about a woman who'd contacted her through her new counterweight initiative. And this was a woman, I think she was an Asian woman, certainly an ethnic minority woman, who was saying she was sick of being told at work or being asked what her experience was like and what it's like being a person of color in a predominantly white work environment. She was basically saying, I want to get on with my work. Can you stop racializing everything? Can you leave me alone? Do you get any sense of how, you know, because the other argument would be, well, you know, if people are given more of a leg up and more advantages, they're going to take it. If it's beneficial to be told that you're going to be a victim forevermore, and therefore you'll have these special, that you're going to take that, you're going to allow that to continue. But see, I would get very annoyed if someone was saying to me, you can have these special advantages just because you're gay. You can, we'll give you an extra job, we'll pay you more, we'll do whatever. And I would be annoyed and I would push back against that. But am I right in thinking that other minority groups are generally doing that? Or what do you think?
I don't think you can look at kind of minority groups or the Black community as a monolith. I think there's really, there's a stratified thing that's happening. I think if you are, and some people will disagree or be even offended by this, but I think it's true, so I'm going to say it. If you are a kind of educated, upwardly mobile, kind of professional class, African-American person in the United States, your opportunities have, I think, in a lot of ways, never been greater. Mm. Companies and academics and institutions are really doing a good job trying to extend opportunities to people of color in those elite institutions. Yeah. But if you are living in a poor Black community in an American inner city, and I say this with some knowledge, I spent 5 years directing a documentary for PBS in America's poorest cities. You know, frankly, your opportunities in some ways have never been worse. I mean, it's really a dire situation. And the solutions that are proffered by the kind of multiracial, kind of elite academic, journalist, governmental class are really convenient for them. Again, people of all races, like Robin DiAngelo, are really convenient for them because they provide opportunities and power and prestige for themselves. Mm. But, you know, I spent 5 years talking to people in public housing projects and poor neighborhoods, and not once did I ever get the sense that they were concerned about any of the issues that the kind of woke intelligentsia is bringing up. They were concerned with really basic human problems. I don't think that kind of white supremacy seminar for Google employees is going to do anything to help the single mother with three kids who's maybe going through a kind of difficult, difficult situation in a housing project on the south side of Memphis. There's such a disconnect that I actually think it really is this kind of narcissistic and really selfish ideology that offers status for elites of all races and really offers nothing for people, again, of all races at the bottom.
Yeah, this is something I felt here in the UK very strongly, is that a lot of the movement is, or the woke movement is very much a bourgeois movement, and that actually they have no interest in economic inequality. They have no interest in class. And of course, that is the main signifier of privilege. And if you were to focus on class and focus on poorer communities, you would end up actually disproportionately helping ethnic minority groups because they are overrepresented within those communities. So, because otherwise all you're doing is elevating BAME people from posh upper middle class backgrounds. And what's the point in that?
Well, because I think the people that are running these programs and are concerned first and foremost with their own cohort, their own peer group, their own colleagues. And they've seen that this is the best way to get a foothold into those elite institutions. I mean, you wield enormous power. You're uncancelable. You're the first to get the offer. And I mean, you're seeing even like Coca-Cola, the kind of, you know, venerable American beverage company, is now saying we're only going to hire corporate law firms that have X percentage of different racial groups. I mean, again, it's like if you are a member of the kind of bachelor's or graduate level or professional degree class, this is a tool to kind of wield power within institutions and gain advantage. And, you know, I don't know. It's a question. I don't know. I wonder if they are cognizant of the fact that it really serves themselves and not others, or if it's kind of a cynical play. I'm not really sure. I don't know.
It's difficult to know, isn't it, what people's intentions are. But the fact that people were so shocked when they saw that the votes for Trump from, for example, LGBT or Black voters had gone up from the 2016, you know, they had actually increased, that people were absolutely shocked by this. But maybe it's because a lot of people from marginalized communities recognized that wokeness doesn't help them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, it is astonishing. I mean, the media spent 4 years calling him a white supremacist, falsely calling him a white supremacist, in my view. And then, you know, Black voters, Latino voters voted for him in greater numbers than in 2016, which were already greater numbers than the last Republican candidate, Mitt Romney, in 2012. So I think there is a shift. And I think, I don't know. I wonder if it's unique to Trump, or I wonder if it's a general shift. But my sense is that what could be happening is as progressives in the United States and maybe in the UK abandon the old kind of promise, right? The promise of FDR, which was economic security, which was employment, which was protection in old age, which was healthcare for people who are unable to provide for themselves. those are kind of universal, very tangible, very basic human goods. And I think that's why they were extremely popular, especially for people lower down the income scale. But when progressives are wrapped up in these very abstract issues of systemic racism and climate change and, you know, et cetera, things that may have some validity, but is very difficult for people to feel that has an impact on their life in a really tangible way, they're going to look for other options and they're not going to stick around. And I think that's what we're seeing happening more and more.
So let's just run with that a little. What if the Republican Party were to suddenly start to push things like, I don't know, socialized medicine or trying to raise people out of poverty, a bit more of that? What would happen then?
Yeah, I'd be really happy to see certainly that latter solution be a big focus. You know, as I mentioned, I spent 5 years working on a film about American poverty, looking at our anti-poverty system. Mm-hmm. In kind of contrast to a lot of my progressive American friends and certainly European friends, the United States actually has a very generous welfare system. The United States spends more on kind of social welfare programs per capita than many European countries. In absolute terms, the United States spends $1.1 trillion per year on means-tested anti-poverty programs. So anti-poverty programs for people below a certain income threshold. $1.1 trillion a year.
That really surprises me because when I've been in America, when I've been in Los Angeles and Chicago, the poverty I've seen there has dwarfed anything I've seen in the UK. It's actually been quite frightening.
It is, yeah. And this is the paradox, right? This is the contradiction. How is it possible that we spend so much money and yet our system seems totally broken to the point where in San Francisco you have, you know, 16,000 people sleeping on the streets. In LA, you have 59,000 people sleeping on the streets. And I would like to see conservatives and political kind of Republicans basically say, how can we use this money? Let's not talk about cutting government or cutting this or cutting that. Let's just, for sake of argument, say we're going to spend the same amount. How can we reform this system to get it out of the hands of bureaucracies and actually into the pockets of American families? How can we accept some economic redistribution? This is a reality in advanced capitalist society. There's going to be redistribution. There should be some redistribution. But how can we make it in a way that rewards work, rewards the kind of family, rewards all of those social institutions that we want, and actually helps people turn that minimum wage job into a family wage job? That's what I think we should do.
Are you suggesting that all of this money, all of this investment is going on bureaucracy largely? Is that what you're saying?
No, I mean, large portions of it, not all of it. I mean, some of it makes its way, but it's always kind of dog-eared or put under requirements or put towards, you know, the medical portion is a huge portion. Obviously, that's going straight to medical providers. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of cash-based redistribution is a small portion of it. And I would like to see it be a much larger portion of it. I would like to see it being tied to paychecks. So basically saying, if you're working that full-time job that's paying you $20,000 or $25,000 a year, how can we boost that with a kind of wage supplement so that that $25,000 a year job is maybe a $35,000 a year job? I think you'd get a lot of good things. You'd get people being kind of brought up out of poverty. You'd support work. You'd make family formation more affordable and more likely for people. You'd encourage families to stay together, and you'd strengthen that kind of working class that, you know, frankly, has been really forgotten in our policies and in our culture.
But isn't there a weird thought there that the working class could actually end up being the natural voting base for the Republicans potentially? But Republicans are always so nervous of wealth redistribution, aren't they?
They are. Yeah, they are. And I think Republicans are really, and conservatives, no insult to all of my friends and colleagues, but in some ways stuck in the Reagan model. And when tax rates were extremely high, corporate taxes and regulation were a big problem. There was kind of stagnant innovation, et cetera, et cetera. At the time, that was the right solution. This kind of Reagan idea of liberalizing the economy. But I think the problems now are very different than they were in the 1980s. And Republicans have promised to kind of cut the welfare state for generations. They've never done it. It's time to have a new strategy to basically say, how can we decentralize the welfare state? How can we take power away from bureaucracies and other kind of centralized institutions and actually get it down to the kind of lowest level, actually entrust poor people with resources and then provide people a kind of mechanism to have a dignified life, even at a lower end of the income scale.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here. I produce Culture Wars and all of Spike's podcasts. I really hope you're enjoying the show so far. This podcast, like all of Spike's content, is free. There's no paywalls or no paid subscriptions. We rely on the support of our loyal listeners and readers like yourself to keep producing our groundbreaking podcasts, interviews, articles, essays, and more. So, if you're a regular listener to this podcast and you're wondering how best to support it, please do consider donating to Spiked, or even better, becoming a regular donor. Even £5 per month can make an enormous difference. To start your regular donation today, just go to spiked-online.com and click the red donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and the red donate button in the top right corner. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
So I know it's really rude to ask people who they voted for, but would you say that you think the future is with the Republicans then?
Moving forward, you mean?
Or generally speaking, I mean, I'm very much aware that a lot of your work formed the basis for Donald Trump's decision to ban the teaching of critical race theory in federal agencies, for instance. So I just wondered to what extent you feel affiliated with that party.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I didn't vote for Donald Trump in 2016 for a lot of the concerns that many people had. I voted third party as a kind of protest vote. I was never really kind of a big Trump supporter, although I was happy with a lot of the policies that he enacted. Frankly, he performed as president on a policy basis much better than I had anticipated, and frankly, much better than most Republican presidents preceding him in my lifetime. So I grew to have a kind of begrudging support and interest. Then he passed an executive order based on my work. I felt then at that point obligated and really excited to support him. So
were you directly involved in that? Like, had anyone contacted you from the White House, or was that just something that happened off the back of your work?
Yeah, you know, I presented kind of the bombshell stories over the course of months, and then had a segment on Tucker Carlson, and then the president saw the segment, and then he had his chief of staff call me the next morning and then work with their White House team to actually, you know, give my feedback on the executive order. So I got to know a lot of great people in the administration, and I got to know a lot of the great work and policy plans that they had been circulating and working on for a second term. So I was proud to cast my vote for Trump in 2020, even with misgivings, obviously.
Yeah, but I think a lot of this stuff comes down to people from different political backgrounds finding allies against this new kind of soft authoritarianism. I think it's not really even a left-right issue anymore, I don't think.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And I think Trump, though, was so polarizing. And he also provided such a convenient foil for the progressive left, because they could say anything that we're doing bad, well, that's because, you know, Donald Trump is a kind of white supremacist, terrorist, or whatever they want to call him. It gave them such an easy excuse to push some of this stuff. And I think that Trump shook up American politics. He shook up world politics. I think there's a lot of good for that. But I think now's the time. Trump is gone. I don't think he's going to come back in a significant way. I think he's now part of the past. But I think he provided this immense opportunity for conservatives to really think about new alliances, about new policies. And my hope is that in 2024, certainly in congressional elections in 2022, we get a new kind of crop of Republican leaders that take some of the good substantive policy lessons from the Trump era, some of those important cultural fights that Trump was the first one was willing to take on, but do so in a way that is more sophisticated, less divisive, less bombastic, where they can advance the agenda without a lot of the baggage that Donald Trump had in a personal capacity.
I've heard Ben Shapiro saying that, you know, if Trump had stayed off Twitter, he would probably still be president. Do you think that's probably right?
I don't think so. No, I think that's totally wrong. I think that you saw that actually. We actually have a test in that. When they banned Trump from Twitter, did he get more powerful or less powerful? He got immensely less powerful. So we have a kind of real world test of that. And I think Twitter was the way for him to engage directly with voters, engage directly with the public, get his message around the kind of mainstream media filter. I think Twitter, in fact, was one of the primary reasons for his success, his ability to use social media.
But would you say that maybe if he had been a bit more moderate in his tone and not raised the temperature in the way that he was apt to do, that maybe?
It's hard to extricate those things. It's hard to disaggregate them. So I don't know, maybe, but that's kind of his personality. I think that, you know, Trump has been a kind of bombastic, larger than life, outrageous figure for decades. I don't think that he was going to let the handlers handle him. And I think, frankly, the kind of blunt nature of his rhetoric was a huge part of his appeal. Was it a double-edged sword, as, you know, Shapiro would suggest? Absolutely, it was. But I just think that it was authentic to him. And I think that a new leader should use authenticity, but hopefully has a personality that is not as kind of divisive as Trump. You know, I think that he's a one of a kind. And I like to see people who can kind of have that maybe a bit more presidential kind of comportment or presidential style of speaking and rhetoric, but really push that agenda that Trump opened up. I think that's a huge opportunity.
I'm a bit old fashioned like this. I don't like political leaders to be funny. You know, I want them to be really serious and on the job and not making me laugh. His Twitter feed was actually funny. This is not the job of the president, as far as I could see. But then, I mean, now that Biden's in office, and of course, one of the first things he did was revoke that executive order. I mean, I'm always a bit skeptical about these executive orders. Anyway, it feels like a way of bypassing the legislature. It feels like, you know, we'll just have this system where every 4 years, you just get a whole new set of executive orders undermining the ones that went before. I mean, nothing's really being achieved there, is it? What do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, sometimes it is. If you construct an executive order in a very sophisticated way, you can create kind of institutional anchors so that they last beyond your term. This, unfortunately, didn't have enough time to do that. But yeah, you're right. In principle, there are some executive orders that can extend into the kind of power of the legislature. But with this executive order, all it did was say, if you are a federal employee, you can no longer stereotype, scapegoat, or demean people in training programs on the basis of race and sex. And if you do this in the corporate capacity, you can no longer contract with the U.S. government. This seems to be well within the president's purview, right? He's the executive. Mm. He's the chief executive of the administration. And he has a kind of not only the right, but the duty to say that the administration under me, those, I guess, 2 million federal employees, have to basically enact my agenda and can't subvert my agenda. So I think he was well within his right, but the risk again, as you say, is, you know, Biden, one of the first 15 things he did on Inauguration Day was scrap the order.
No, I mean, I think Trump's order was right. My point, I suppose, is, I mean, the way it was reported over here was Trump bans diversity training, which absolutely isn't what it was.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, it didn't ban diversity training. It actually said you can do diversity training. You just can't stereotype, scapegoat, or demean people on the basis of race or sex. So you can't be a racist or a sexist in diversity trainings. And somehow that became the kind of left-wing meme became, oh, well, that's just because Trump hates diversity. And it's like, oh my God.
I mean, that's it's so just, simplistic,
it's
isn't
so
it?
So simplistic and it's cynical. People knew better. New York Times reported on it as Trump, you know, tries to basically tap into white resentment with a diversity training ban.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know for a fact that the New York Times reporter, Peter Baker, he had seen all of the reporting that I had done. I sent it to him when he asked for comment. And I said, Peter, you know, you have to grapple with the fact that they took a group of white male executives at our National Nuclear Weapons Laboratory, forced them to deconstruct their identity, told them that they were analogous to the KKK and white supremacists and lynchings, and then forced them to write letters of apology to kind of fictitious women and people of color after they denounced their own racial identity.
I mean, that's a struggle session.
Yeah, it's not diversity training, it's a struggle session. And of course, our intrepid correspondent, the New York Times, ignored all of the factual reporting and went with this narrative that, you know, Trump is stoking, you know, hatred of diversity, which couldn't be further from the truth.
I don't think anyone takes the New York Times seriously anymore. I hope not, anyway. What do you think are the implications of Biden's revoking of that executive order now?
We're going to see this become kind of further institutionalized and further entrenched in the bureaucracy. I think what he'll probably do, I would expect that he's going to be making a lot of these trainings mandatory in certain agencies, maybe in all agencies. I also think that you're going to see departments of diversity or departments of equity or departments of inclusion within all of the federal agencies. I think that's going to be the next step. And the goal there is to monitor essentially political officers or political monitors within the agencies, pushing this ideology, creating enforcement. And we've seen it actually already in the federal financial agencies in the United States under the Obama administration put in one of these offices of women and minority empowerment, something like that. And employees within the federal agencies have told me these are basically ideological commissars. They're bombing us with kind of far left wing indoctrination all day, everyday emails. They're hosting sessions and they're actively attempting to kind of purge conservative opinion and purge conservative employees from the workforce to maintain this kind of rigid ideological orthodoxy. So I think we're going to see the federal agencies, which up until this point have at least purported to been neutral or acting in the public good, become actually ideological arms of critical race theory and the assorted belief systems.
Are you suggesting that Biden is a kind of Trojan horse figure insofar as wasn't he elected because he was the non-woke candidate. Isn't that why we didn't end up with Elizabeth Warren, for instance?
It's hard to tell. I think it's a bit complicated. I don't think that Biden is the Trojan horse in the sense that he has this kind of sinister agenda that he's always wanted to enact, but he's pretending to be moderate. That's, some people are arguing that. I think it's...
No, what I mean is, are they using him to get into the White House and that actually he's a kind of marionette and other people are pulling the strings? I suppose that's what I'm saying.
I don't think that's exactly it either. I think it's less kind of sinister than that. I think it's really that Biden is a pragmatic politician. Biden does what is popular at the time. He knows how to make alliances. He knows where the energy is. He knows where his political base stands. And he's trying to basically have it all ways, which I think is actually very savvy and sophisticated political strategy and why he's been in political life for, you know, more than half a century. He knows that racial equity agenda, critical race theory have to happen for his base. So he's bringing in people into the administration at the cabinet and sub-cabinet level that are pushing this very hard, while he kind of stays above the fray and can kind of talk about equity in very general terms, can talk about unity. But I think he is passing out the political spoils to his base, right, which is absolutely fired up on this stuff. And they're going to put it in practice in the administration.
So what can be done about it? You're working on this initiative now where you're actually going to attempt to challenge people legally. Well, not people, but you're challenging corporations, aren't you? And anyone, can you talk to us about it? Could you explain what exactly you're intending to do?
Yeah, what we're doing is, once, you know, Biden won the election in November, I realized the executive order was going to get scrapped. So I immediately started reaching out to conservative legal institutions, foundations, law firms, private attorneys. And I basically said, hey, who's working on this issue? Who's going to start filing lawsuits? And the unanimous response was nobody. Nobody's working on this. We're focused on economics, regulations, taxes, traditional kind of economic conservative issues. We don't have anyone that is pushing on critical race theory. It's too new. And I said, well, great. Can I pass along all of the potential plaintiffs and materials and information that I have? And unfortunately, they said, well, we're not really outfitted to do this. So I took some leadership and recruited a team of small foundations, small law firms, individual lawyers. And now we have more than 100 people volunteered to take place in this initiative to sue schools, to sue government agencies, to sue corporations that are conducting these critical race theory based programs. And our goal is really to get one of these cases to the Supreme Court and show decisively that they violate the U.S. Constitution and they violate the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Yeah, I want to ask you, where does this stand legally? Because obviously I'm no expert on American law. Where does this stand constitutionally, critical race theory? Because it does seem to be discriminatory quite in its essence, I suppose.
Yeah, it doesn't stand anywhere, actually. That's what's so interesting about it. There have been no cases filed until we launched this legal effort because it's so new.
Right.
There's been no challenge to it. So there's no case law. There's no precedent. There's no really kind of codified legal rules around it. And that's what we're trying to get done. But my view, and this is a view that is shared by many people, is that critical race theory judges you on the basis of race. It traffics in racial stereotypes. It creates a hostile working environment when it turns into struggle sessions. And it also compels speech. It violates people's right to conscience because it tells them you have to say X, Y, and Z, even if it violates your religious beliefs. So those are all avenues that we can challenge it on. So we can challenge it on First Amendment grounds. We can challenge it on the U.S. Civil Rights Act. We can challenge it on the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. There's a lot of different avenues, and we're trying to be very strategic and tactical where we challenge it, where we have the best shot. But I think that among those three different kind of possibilities, I'm confident that we're going to win, and we're going to keep filing lawsuits to keep in the news, to keep in the public eye, to raise the profile, to hopefully discourage companies and institutions from conducting or implementing these programs in the first place. And then eventually, I think we'll win in the courts and actually settle this issue that this ideology is not only morally and intellectually bankrupt, but it's actually illegal under U.S. law.
I mean, it's good to hear you sound so confident about that. Because of course, as you say, I mean, all it would really take is one high profile case to set the precedent. Because you would kind of open the floodgates there, wouldn't you, of anyone who has been discriminated at work on the basis of being white, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, corporate lawyers are very kind of attuned to legal risks, right? So what would happen is, as soon as we get a judgment in the court, this is my hope, every corporate lawyer in America would say, we need to do a full review of our diversity programs, of our HR programs, and we need to get rid of anything that would create legal liability, because we would have made this issue, not only turn this issue into a kind of precedent in the courts, but actually turned it into a disincentive to do it in the first place. And I think it would have an immediate impact on, frankly, every institution in the country.
I think it would, and particularly with corporations who are there to make money after all. And if they see CRT as actually a big white elephant, they're going to lose a lot of money by promoting it, then they'll probably ditch it pretty quickly. You know, because I'm not convinced they believe in this stuff.
Yeah, I think it's very cynical. I don't think they believe in it at all. I think it's a way to essentially buy off activist organizations that would boycott or protest them. I think it's also a way to kind of signal what is kind of high status within kind of professional class communities. And then I think it's also a kind of very cheap and easy thing for them to do that buys them, you know, kind of good political will. So it's cynical. It's only kind of skin deep at this point. It isn't into the actual DNA of the corporation. So
yes.
I think it'll be easy to get rid of it.
Well, I wish you the best with it, because I think this is going to be a really key tool. But I also think, irrespective of the legal situation, we do still need to win the argument. We need that liberal approach that people understand why this is wrong and that people are willing to stand up against it. I wonder whether the tipping point is going to be the fact that this is affecting children now so much. I think once you start messing with people's kids, you know, I think they take a stand. You know, I mean, where do mixed race parents stand on this stuff when the parents are told to go in one room or the other on the basis of their race? So are we telling kids of mixed race parents that their one parent is the oppressor and the other is the oppressed? I don't think people are going to stand for it.
Yeah, that's what I hope, you know. And even my own family, my wife and kids were a kind of biracial family. And yeah, it's like, wait a minute, where do my kids go? Are they white? Yeah. Are they people of color? Like, they're going to be very confused about this. And it doesn't really make any sense. And I hope that you're right. And that's why I'm really focusing my reporting right now on education, because I hope that parents can say, well, you know, it's just some people in the federal government. Who cares? It doesn't affect me. I'm hoping that once people see this affects you, this affects your local institutions, this affects your children, this is actually going to hurt their future. It's going to divide them from their friends and their parents or their community. I'm hoping that that will be the tipping point. That will be the kind of a catalyst for people to wake up and get involved. And we'll see. This is going to be a big campaign of mine in the next 6 months. And we'll have to check in, you know, after it's over.
That'd be great. What a nice optimistic tone to finish on. Thanks so much, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You've been listening to Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle, and Christopher Rufo. Really enjoyed that. I think you'll agree that some of Christopher's stories are genuinely quite chilling, and that I think the conclusion has to be that we just all need to be a little bit braver when it comes to this stuff. We need to stop kowtowing to the zealots. So there you go. That's the message of today's show. Make sure you do the usual stuff that you like, you subscribe, follow Christopher on Twitter. He's at RealChrisRufo. So that you can be kept updated by the woke horror stories that are emerging in mainstream institutions over in the US, and make sure they don't happen over here. See you next time.